This is Kim Glass, the Executive Director of the Blue-Green Alliance, and we're here today because we've had a little time to digest the actual text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and we wanted to give you our first impressions. You will be hearing from several BGA partners and allies that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a flawed trade agreement that threatens environmental sustainability, limits the rights of workers, and undermines our manufacturing and tradable service sectors. Today, they will highlight four key areas where they believe this agreement falls short. First, America's manufacturing sector continues to be a huge concern for our economy, and the TPP threatens quality manufacturing jobs. Second, we have concerns about the TPP's investor-state dispute system. We believe it weakens America's environmental and labor laws. Third, the agreement doesn't do enough for basic human and workers' rights in other countries. And finally, the deal falls short of ensuring other nations live up to our environmental standards. We have several speakers on the call today. We're ready to get started. So I'm going to turn this over now to BGA's co-chair, our co-leader of BGA from the Sierra Club, Executive Director Michael Broom. Mike?
Thanks, Kim. As you just heard, I'm Michael Broom, Executive Director of the Sierra Club. And I suppose that there's one good thing to say about TPP is that it has strengthened the alliance between labor, environmental groups, community activists, and everybody who's working for a clean and prosperous future. We now have evidence that the Trans-Pacific Partnership threatens our families and our communities, and also our air, water, our jobs, and our clean energy economy. We have seen that the deal is over 6,000 pages long, but the words climate change don't appear once in the text. This is unacceptable at a time when leaders from around the world are calling on all governments to do everything in their power to address the climate crisis. This summer, Pope Francis shined a light on the moral obligation that we all share to address our climate change obligation, which is one that transcends borders and transcends politics. This deal completely ignores this reality, and it is not the 21st century trade deal that we have been promised. The TPP is a huge step backwards. It puts power in the hands of foreign corporations to challenge our environmental and climate safeguards in unaccountable trade tribunals with the controversial, as Kim mentioned, investor-state dispute settlement system. This is a corporate power grab that has been used in past deals to challenge clean energy initiatives, bans, moratoriums on fossil fuel practices, and much more. The TPP would also take away our ability to make informed choices about our energy future. The Trans-Pacific Partnership would require, the Department of Energy to automatically approve all exports of natural gas to countries in the PAC without any analysis of the impacts of exporting natural gas on our environment, our communities, our jobs, or our economy. The Sierra Club has done a full analysis on the deal's chapter on the environment. We have been told, and there have been some articles, saying that this would be the strongest ever, but we have concluded that many provisions are toothless. They are weak. They don't do what they profess to do. The provisions on multilateral environmental treaties even fail to meet the minimum standards for environmental protection established in the fast-track law and included in past trade deals negotiated under George W. Bush. We've seen that poachers won't be forced to stop their dangerous practices, loggers won't be forced to halt their illegal logging operations, and criminals won't be held accountable because of weak suggestions in the rule rather than mandates in the agreement. A trade deal that protects our wildlife and the environment would actually require countries to change their ways, and the TPP failed to do that. Our labor and environmental allies have worked tirelessly to reveal the threats of this deal, to encourage the members of Congress to vote against it, and build a new model of trade that puts people before profits. I want to just highlight one example. I know we have other speakers, but I want to talk about one thing in this agreement, just to make this specific. There has been talk about the conservation rules in this agreement and that the fact that the agreement is broader than previous agreements. And although it's true that the range of conservation issues that are mentioned in the TPP might be wide, the obligations, meaning what countries are actually required to do, are shallow. their vague obligations that are combined with weak enforcement, which will allow countries to continue their business as usual practices that threaten the environment. So, for example, for the illegal trade in flora and fauna, rather than prohibiting trade in illegally logged timber or wildlife, which are major issues in countries like Peru and Vietnam, the TPP only asks countries to, quote, to combat such trade. So they don't say this has to stop. They just say you have to work on it. And to comply, the tech requires very weak measures, quote, such as exchanging information and experiences, while stronger measures like sanctions are listed as options. In our house, if my wife and I want to keep an orderly house, we don't ask our kids to exchange their information and experiences about cleaning their room. We say you need to clean your room if you want to play video games. We need a trade agreement that actually enforces strong provisions to protect our forests, to protect our workers, to protect our climate, and protect our communities. This trade agreement does not do that. So Congress must stand up for American jobs, clean air, clean water, and a healthy climate by rejecting the toxic Trans-Pacific Partnership. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mike. And now I have the distinct pleasure of introducing the Communication Workers of America President, Chris Shelton. Chris?
Good morning. Thanks to all of you for joining us, and special thanks to Leo Gerard, Mike Brune, and Jake Schmidt for joining the call today. Last week, we finally, and I do mean finally, got to see the text of the TPP for the first time. But big corporate interests have had close access to the deal for the last several years while the deal was being negotiated in secret. The text of the TPP shows just how big of an impact big corporations have had on this deal. The deal does nothing to boost the wages of American workers or protect the environment, but it makes it much easier for those corporations to ship jobs overseas to low-wage countries with weak labor and environmental protections. A deal that lets countries like Japan continue to manipulate their currencies to make their goods cheaper is not a good deal for American workers. A deal that lets Vietnam off the hook from protecting workers' rights for at least 5 years is not a good deal for American workers. A deal that gives trade benefits to Brunei, even while Brunei's women, religious minorities, and LGBT individuals face stoning and other attacks, is not a good deal for American workers, or certainly for not workers in Brunei. And a deal that provides multinational corporations a special right to sue sovereign nations in international tribunals and denies any similar rights to unions, environmentalists, is certainly not a good deal for American workers. The truth of the matter is very simple. The TPP is a deal written by and for multinational corporations to help them profit at the direct expense of our workers and our environment. That's a deal that we cannot afford. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chris. And now I'm going to turn it over to Leo Gerard, the co-chair of the Blue-Green Alliance and the international president of the United Steelworkers. Leo? Okay, maybe we have some technical difficulties. So now I'm going to introduce Jake Schmidt. He is the director of the International Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Jake?
Great. Thanks, everyone, for joining. And as Kim said, I'm Jake Schmidt. I direct the International Program at the Natural Resource Defense Council. Obviously, we've now finally seen the details of this agreement, and it's important to look for us at the broad sweep of provisions within this agreement, not just to the environment chapter. So for us, the finalized agreement.
Somehow I tried to speak and they couldn't hear me.
Would you like me to stop or continue with Leo?
Hello.
Hello, Jake?
Yeah.
Yes, is this Leo?
It is.
Okay, hi, Leo.
Something went wrong.
Okay, so apologies for that. Jake, can we just pause for 1 second?
Let Jake go, and I'll come on the end.
Okay, go ahead, Jake.
That's all right. Thank you. So the finalized agreement, as you heard from from our previous speakers would have expanded rights to challenge our environmental laws and special trade tribunals outside the U.S. court system. This mechanism, you know, investor-state dispute settlement, would bypass domestic court systems and allow companies to sue governments for financial compensation. You know, the threat of a lawsuit can create a chilling effect on new safeguards as governments fear that they will have huge financial payouts if they strengthen the rules. And we've seen this in the real world be implemented and challenged both provisions within the United States but other countries' environmental laws. This agreement will significantly expand the number of companies that now have the ability to bring those lawsuits both within the United States and challenge other countries' laws. This provision, as we see it, could lead to, could put at risk all of our environmental and public health safeguards, including our climate safeguards, chemical laws, and food safety laws. In addition, this agreement does not do enough in the environment chapter to advance conservation issues in this critical region. The agreement fails a number of the tests set out by members of Congress and the environmental community as minimum conservation provisions for free trade agreements in the past century and in the 21st century. For example, it fails to include strong provisions to address trade in illegal wood and wood products. While the agreement does include a provision on that regards, we view it as a provision that unfortunately you could drive several logging trucks through. While there is some progress on issues like fishery subsidies in the agreement and some illegal trade in endangered species, we have serious doubts about whether these and other provisions in the environment chapter will be enforced. After all, strong provisions and no enforcement does not lead to changes on the ground. USTR, as you know, has yet to bring an enforcement case for a country that violates its environmental obligations under previous free trade agreements. A number of groups, including NRDC, have raised formally with USTR clear violations, in our opinion, by Peru in the U.S. free trade agreement, the environmental chapters, and yet there has been no case brought against Peru for those clear violations. So this raises serious doubts in our minds about whether or not these provisions will actually be enforced on the ground, irregardless of whether or not they're actually meaningfully able to be implemented. There's other chapters that also impact upon the environmental and public health safeguards, so it's important, obviously, to look beyond the environment chapter to see the full impacts. These are provisions around food safety, our ability to regulate in the public interest and set stronger safeguards going forward in chapters like the regulatory coherence chapter. As this agreement stands, there are substantial shortcomings that should lead Congress to reject it, in our view. Thank you. With that, I'll turn it over to Leo.
Thank you very much, Jake. Let me just pick up where some of my colleagues were and give you some hard facts. We've already lost close to 60,000 jobs prior to the TPP since NAFTA. And the Peterson Institute, which is not a rabid left-wing organization by any measure, and the Wall Street Journal, have both put out studies that they've done. The Peterson Institute pointed out that we'll have a trade deficit in heavy manufacturing of almost $55 billion a year by 2025, costing the U.S. about 330,000 jobs. We'll have another trade deficit in light manufacturing of similar amounts. We'll have another trade deficit in car transport equipment of similar amounts. And I've come to the conclusion and said so publicly, this is like a dagger in the heart of American manufacturing. And I've also come to the conclusion, when you look at the disputes of the ISDS, when you look at currency, when you look at state-owned enterprises, when you look at rules of origin, none of those have been addressed in a way that would protect or create jobs in America. And if you really do the analysis of that, along with the fact that they're negotiating a BIT agreement with China on services and a TTIP agreement with Europe, the objective is to have rearranged the global economy so that corporations can do what they want, where they want, when they want. And it has much negative impact on American workers and American jobs. The other thing is that we understand that the rules of origin, and I want to make this as clear as I can, on the rules of origin, depending on what kind of documentation there is on how they put value on various auto parts, it'll be somewhere between 30 and 45% that would have to be made in a TPP country to have what I would call non-duty access. That means that up to 55% can come some other place. Welcome to China, who have already announced they want to put $100 billion of auto parts into the North American market. Then we look at, again, if that's going to happen, if I'm a bit parochial, we look at what happens in steel auto parts. And for every ton of steel that comes from China versus being made in America, for every ton of steel that would come from one of those other countries, that they have 3 to 4 times the amount of greenhouse gas emission as that we do. And we have one of the cleanest steel industries on the planet. There's discussion going on, apparently, about currency manipulation. But again, and like Michael said and like Jake said and others, that unenforceable. When we know that Vietnam, Japan, in particular, Malaysia, Singapore, they've all been currency manipulators in the past to give themselves economic advantage over our manufacturing base. And as I pointed out, on the rules of origin, if you need 45% to come from TPP countries, well, that includes Vietnam, where regardless of what we're told, they don't recognize free and independent unions. And even if that was the case, the hourly rate is something under $1 an hour. We go to Malaysia, where we know there's forced labor. The State Department had to release their document on forced labor after the fast track vote was passed, because they didn't want it to have negative impact, because Malaysia still uses forced labor. And in Brunei, where they practice Sharia law, unions aren't allowed. So when it took 6 years for our government to declare that Guatemala wasn't following their agreement, little country like Guatemala, what do you think we're going to get done in Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, Singapore? So this is a total disaster for working people in America. This is a total disaster for industrial workers. It's a total disaster for the environment. As Michael Bruin said, we've always had a close relationship with the environmental movement, but this strengthens our relationship. We've always had a close relationship with the anti-poverty movement. This strengthens that relationship. And this is a deal that is designed to let corporations, along with the other trade deals they're negotiating, have free rein of the global manufacturing base. And it's something we need to get defeated. And there's no member of Congress that should feel safe voting for this.
Okay. Thank you, Leo. And now we're going to hear from our last speaker, Celeste Drake, the trade policy specialist at the AFL-CIO. Celeste?
Thanks, Kim. I want to start by saying the AFL-CIO is not a member of the Blue-Green Alliance, but we're pleased to participate in this call and to work with BGA on a number of important issues for workers. The TPP is a corporate rights agreement. It is neither innovative nor groundbreaking, except in its efforts to expand monopoly rights to pharmaceutical companies and to expand power and influence to foreign investors. The TPP's text does not demonstrate that any lessons have been learned from the failures of current trade policy. And in fact, many of those failures have been reincorporated into the TPP. On labor in particular, it continues to put forth some vague standards which question whether or not they could be enforced, assuming enforcement actions were ever taken. The GAO did a study that was published in November of last year pointing out the failure of the U.S. to properly monitor and implement labor promises made in past agreements. And there's not a single change to the enforcement mechanism of this text that would allow workers to think anything other than enforcement efforts for their rights will either be non-existent, very weak, or severely delayed. As President Girard pointed out, we're nearly to 8 years in the Guatemala case, and that continues. There are also outstanding cases against Honduras, against Bahrain, and in no case have these workers seen an improvement in their day-to-day working conditions as a result of promises made in trade agreements. The record for the environmental enforcement is worse. The U.S. has neither self-initiated any enforcement action under the environment provisions, nor has responded to public petitions to do so. Based on workers' experience, particularly with Colombia, Honduras, and Guatemala, we can actually expect worker repression to get worse in TPP countries following the implementation of the TPP, because global firms will then begin to exercise their influence to encourage a race to the bottom in wages, working conditions, and environmental regulation. The TPP's lack of climate change provisions is likely to spur further outsourcing if the U.S. actually implements the climate deal it made with China. The TPP's lack of any currency provisions is likely to further spur outsourcing, which actually increases profits to outsourcers who then export back to the United States for sale. The side agreements in the labor chapter do not at all go beyond the basic promises in the chapter. They are just a list of ways that Brunei, Malaysia, and Vietnam need to act to bring their laws into basic compliance. They contain nothing on measuring implementation of those legal changes or enforcement of those legal changes. And in fact, for Vietnam, it gives Vietnam a free ride for a minimum of 5 years to not, in fact, enforce freedom of association as directed by international labor standards. And frankly, they don't include anything on Mexico or Peru, both of which have outstanding complaints under the labor mechanism of existing agreements with those countries. And I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Celeste. So I'm going to turn it back to the operator to give some direction on how people can ask questions.
Certainly, the floor is now open for your questions. If you have a question or comment, please press 7 on your telephone keypad.
And then we've heard from a variety of speakers today from across the labor and environmental movement that the TPP is a flawed trade agreement that threatens our environmental sustainability, it limits the rights of workers, and undermines our manufacturing and tradable service sectors. And we'll take any question that we have.
Okay, the first question comes from Ryan Rainey. Ryan, the floor is yours.
Hi, guys. Thanks very much for doing this call from Inside U.S. Trade. The White House just said today that they're continuing to work with Mexico on some parallel reforms on labor issues. And I just wanted to address this question to the folks on the call from the labor community. Are you taking a position on if these reforms need to be concluded before a implementing bill is submitted or before a congressional vote? Are you still trying to get the administration to come to an agreement, or is your focus now on the TPP itself and the debate in Congress?
Let's leave it, Gerard. Let me hop in, because this is, in some ways, it's rather insulting. Not your question, but the fact that they tell us that they're still working. Let me remind you that NAFTA is more than 20 years old, and Mexico is an original partner, and we started, we being the labor movement, pointing out the flaws in Mexican labor policy and violations of ILO standards in every which way you'd like to measure it. And to tell us that they're continuing to work at it is an insult. This should be very simple. If these trade agreements were about trade and they were about protecting American jobs, we'd have a time limit that says if you didn't meet this standard by this date, then you wouldn't be able to have access. And that if you think that 20 years or more on Mexico is going to make it easier on Brunei, it's going to make it easier on Malaysia, it's going to make it easier on on Vietnam to use them as examples when after 20 years we haven't resolved Mexico? It's just foolishness. And it's a fundamental misrepresentation of the facts. And we can do the same thing as Celeste mentioned in Colombia. After the Colombia deal, persecution of workers didn't decline, it increased. We look at South Korea. Workers have had a much harder time in South Korea since that South Korean deal. So we have to defeat the TPP, and there's still, even if, after we defeat the TPP, there's still a NAFTA provision that we need to get Mexico and to come into line with the standard that we've been promised. And I say 20 years plus. So it's an insult that they tell us they're still working on it.
Okay, next question.
Next question comes from Mary Berger. Mary, the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you. This is Mary Berger with Washington Trade Daily. What are the groups planning to do now in terms of convincing lawmakers to vote against this deal? Mr. Girard, I think you said something about no member should feel safe voting for this. I'm assuming you're going to make this a really big issue in the campaign.
Well, look, I don't have to say that I will do that. Our members will do that. We had several meetings of rank and file folks that are in our building this week, and these meetings were planned long before the TPP, but I went up to speak to them, and basically their view is industrial workers and the environment are getting the short end of the stick here, and they demand that we go do something, and a couple of them said they would never vote for someone who votes to literally give away their job. So we're not making threats, but we're saying we're going to come and tell the constituents in their districts the truth, and we're going to bring the facts from the TPP, and it is, people have said in the past, the TPP is literally NAFTA on steroids. It makes it worse in every category. And so we're going to do a massive education job of both Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, this is Chris Shelton. I have to echo what Leo said. My members absolutely believe that if they're going to lose their jobs, that the people who vote for this should lose their jobs also. And, you know, we'll do whatever we have to do to make sure our members and everybody else understands that what these folks are voting for is shipping American jobs overseas.
All right. Next question.
The next question comes from Mark Grunberg. Mark, the floor is yours.
Yeah, this is a follow-up to the last question for Leo and for Chris. A year from now, we have the presidential election. Let's, for the sake of for talking points, assume that this thing does squeak through. What's the reaction of working people? Do they sit home and discuss? Do they campaign for the other party? And if so, who and how many? Come on, in terms of working people, who would do what?
Well, all I can say at this point is what I already said, that we certainly haven't had a huge national conference yet, but we've had probably in the last 10 days, we probably had 10 different groups of our members in for trainings on various things that were pre-scheduled. And in every one of them, the level of disappointment and frustration and anger, literally, is palpable. And many of them have told us that they're going to work as hard as they can in their districts to talk to their members of Congress, in particular House of Representatives, whether it's Democrats or Republicans or independents. They want to have a direct discussion about what this agreement means to them and their future. And, you know, we haven't even talked about what the downward pressure from these trade deals. We talked about the technicalities and the specifics of the trade deals. But these trade deals are put downward pressure on, and there's not one set of negotiations that our union is in where the employer doesn't come out and say, well, look, it's in the global economy, we got to compete with China here, so we need you to give up your health care or give up your pensions or do something. And it's used as a corporate tool to put downward pressure on wages and benefits, and we wonder why we've got income inequality higher than it's ever been. And so do you think it's going to be any better when we're told that we have to compete now with not only with China, not only with South Korea, not only with Colombia, but now we have to compete with Vietnam? This is a prescription for economic disaster as far as we're concerned, and we say it again. This trade deal puts a knife in the heart of manufacturing.
Let me take one more question.
Next question comes from Adam Bassetti. Adam, the floor is yours.
Yes, thanks for hosting the call. This is Adam Bassetti from Politico. It seems like the administration is standing by the number they got for TPA as sort of a benchmark for support for TPP. I mean, what is the strategy for sort of peeling away some of the Democrats that may have supported TPP? Just wondering, you know, if there's, you know, the ability to get some of those Democrats to vote against this deal that were supportive of TPA.
Go ahead, Celeste.
Sure. I just think that the text actually is the most powerful weapon that we have now, rather than members of Congress having to rely on characterizations of what the text means, that those members can't actually check with anybody because of the secrecy of the text. They can now look and see that the negotiators actually overpromised on what they were delivering for the environmental chapter, and they can see that it doesn't, in fact, meet the May 10th standard, and that the vast majority of it is non-enforceable because it contains words like may and endeavor to encourage and things of this nature. They'll be able to see that the promises made about access to medicines, again, do not even live up to the Bush-era May 2007 standard. They'll be able to see that there, in fact, is nothing really new or innovative in the investment chapter that reforms the egregiousness of ISDS and its attack on our democracy and our domestic choices. And, in fact, the carve-out for tobacco is, in fact, an admission that the ISDS system is open for abuse and ripe for abuse. And if it wasn't ripe for such abuse, there would be no need to give a total carve-out to protections for tobacco control. And in fact, the question should be reversed. Why only protections for tobacco control? You know, isn't it the case that companies besides tobacco companies would like to use the system to attack environmental regulations, labor standards, wage standards, project labor agreements, food safety standards, cosmetics directive, any of these issues? And so I think as members become more familiar with the text, some who believed the hype may not be so willing to do so. And those votes are really going to be up for grabs.
Yeah, this is Christian. When people voted for TPA, a lot of them said that they would vote for TPA, but they'd have to see the text of the actual deal before they could vote for TPP. Well, we're going to hold them to that, and we believe that there's enough folks to turn down this TPP, and we're going to try to make sure that happens.
I want to support what Chris and Celeste said. The fact, it's Leo Gerard, the fact is that a lot of the Democrats in particular that voted for Fast Track did so on the basis that they didn't want to deny Fast Track till they got to see the agreement. And there were promises made in order to get that vote. And now when they've got the agreement, as Celeste said, it's our best weapon to say, you said that if they didn't get this or didn't get that, you'd be against it. Well, they didn't get it. And not only in many cases did they not get it, in some cases they made it worse. And so I think that There's a handful of Democrats in the House that voted for this, and I think we have to do it and challenge them based on the promises they made of how they would vote once they saw the agreement and if it wasn't meeting a certain standard, which it hasn't met. So I agree with Chris and Celeste.
All right. Well, I want to take a moment to thank you, Leo, and I want to thank for all the call participants today, the speakers, the reporters that are on the line. If you have any follow-up questions, feel free to reach out to the Blue-Green Alliance, and thank you all so much.